DW Africa Link.
Hello and a warm welcome to this edition of Africa Link, coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. My name is Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Zipporah Nyambura. We are also live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Feel free to share this audio and join in the debate.
That's right, indeed. Coming up, President Muhammadu Buhari extends his lead in Nigeria's election as results continue to trickle in.
Now, does it tell us anything about what the final result is going to be? I will be very careful with that, because if you look at certain states, two states, for example, that went to Buhari with a difference of 1%.
In Sudan, the state of emergency declared by President al-Bashir enters the fifth day. Effects of these are already being felt across the country.
It is staggering that Bashir still remains in power. If anything, he's consolidated his power. And the reason for that is that he's been very successful in playing the divisions within his own country. So we need tougher economic sanctions. We need to interrupt the flow of arms into Sudan.
Plus, another setback for the Catholic Church as a top Vatican official, Australian Cardinal Pell, is found guilty of sexual abuse.
Do not miss out on the details of these stories coming up shortly after the World News in Brief.
DW News.
I'm Kasina Kripal with the DW News. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari's election lead grew on Tuesday during a second day of announcing state-by-state election results. Meanwhile, the death toll from violence linked to Saturday's vote increased from 39 to 47, according to civil society election monitors. Despite the violence and accusations of rigging by the opposition led by Atiku Abubakar, analyst Olayinka Jala told DW Africa that polls showed that democracy in Nigeria was on the right track.
New people are coming into the fold and the old guard are gradually giving way. The so-called godfathers are actually losing their sway in Nigerian politics. A very good example is the current Senate president actually just lost his seat. Before, it's very difficult for you to have people of such political strength actually losing in their holds.
In Somalia, police suspect the jihadist group Al-Shabaab to be behind the killings on Tuesday of 9 people in a village near the capital, Mogadishu. Gunmen opened fire on 4 women and 5 men from refugee camps in Haubadi in the state of Lower Shabelle. Meanwhile, the U.S. military claimed to have killed 35 Al-Shabaab militants in a recent airstrike in central Somalia. Photos and film footage of a meeting by President Ali Bongo of Gabon with the heads of several state organs were released today. Bongo returned overnight from Morocco, where he has been receiving treatment after suffering a stroke in October. His prolonged absence stoked concern about a vacuum of power, apparently sparking a brief attempted coup by renegade soldiers on January 7th. Sudanese continued to take to the streets today, defying a presidential ban on unauthorized public gatherings. Protesters across the country called for the resignation of President Omar al-Bashir. This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. India bombed a training camp from militants of the Jaish-e-Mohammed or JEM group in Pakistani territory today, Foreign Secretary Vijay Keshav Gokhale announced. JEM claimed credit for a suicide attack that killed 40 Indian paramilitary police in Kashmir in February. An Indian government source said 300 militants had been killed. The head of India's diplomacy, Gokhale, said,
"We expect that Pakistan lives up to its public commitment and takes follow-up action to dismantle all JEM and other camps and hold the terrorists accountable for their actions."
Pakistan denied any casualties, and Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi said his country reserves the right to self-defense after Indian jets crossed into its territory. British Prime Minister Theresa May promised to allow Parliament to delay Brexit by up to 3 months to keep Britain from leaving the European Union without a deal on the scheduled departure date of March 29. The reversal in May's strategy came after threats of mass resignations from her ministers and calls for a second referendum from the main opposition Labour Party. In Australia, Roman Catholic Cardinal George Pell, one of Pope Francis' closest advisers, was found guilty of sexually assaulting 2 choir boys aged 12 and 13. He is the most senior Catholic cleric ever convicted of child sex crimes. And on to sports, the World Football Association, FIFA, has imposed a life ban on referee Odin Charles Mbaga of Tanzania for taking bribes. Mbaga was also fined $200,000. For more news and information, please visit our website at dw.com. I'm Christina Kripal.
And this is Africa Link coming to life from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. My name is Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Zipporah Nyambura. A warm welcome to all of you listening to us on Facebook there, Macden Wangang and Remungs Ifyanyi. You all have a lot to tell us about Nigeria, so stick here.
And of course, we started from there where President Muhammadu Buhari extended his lead over his arch-rival Atiku Abubakar following the second results announcement. Provisional results announced in state capitals, but not yet confirmed by the Electoral Commission, indicated that Buhari had a commanding lead of 52% to 44% over his main rival, businessman and former Vice President Atiku Abubakar.
The election has, however, been hampered by news of violence, indicating that death toll in vote-related violence rose to 53 as an extremist attack was found to be worse than first reported. On the ground is Fanny Fatcha, who starts by telling us how the results stand so far.
Almost half of all states have been announced so far. 10 states were called for Buhari's APC party. 7 states plus Abuja were called for the challenging rival party, the opposition party, PDP. Now, does it tell us anything about what the final result is going to be? I will be very careful with that, because if you look at certain states, 2 states, for example, that went to Buhari with a difference of 1%, shows you that it is a very fiercely contested competition here. One state was won by the PDP by less than 0.2%. Now, there's certain states, of course, where the margin is much higher. It's not as narrow. In the north, for example, where Buhari collected a couple of states. In the south, where APC is stronger. I would definitely wait and see how this day plays out, but it may actually drag on until tomorrow or even further until all results are being collected and finally a president, either incumbent president or a new president, is named for Nigeria.
The opposition is already alleging manipulation and vote rigging in favor of Buhari. Can you tell us the latest on this?
That is correct. So the opposition party did accuse the governing party of vote rigging. They continue to say that they are not going to accept results. They are continuing to say that the governing party is colluding with INEC in trying to have a result in their favor. Now, and as I say, there was no suggestion by any international observer or any local observer that a vote rigging took place. So therefore, it's a very delicate situation, and there's a lot of political rhetoric, of course, involved, as I say, because it's such a fiercely contested battle, this election in 2019 in Nigeria.
But what is Nigeria's electoral body, INEC, saying in regard to all this?
The electoral body is saying that they are an independent electoral commission. Those accusations were actually pretty increasing once that there was this delay 1 week ago that the election was postponed. So they're actually trying to stay firm in their image that they're an independent commission and they are not catering to neither of these parties, while, as you just point out, both parties are accusing each other of wrongdoing, of manipulating the votes when it comes to the thesis that either APC or PDP is colluding in one way or the other with INEC. What is more interesting, I think, on that level is to listen and hear what international observers, but also local observers, had to say. No one of them suggested vote rigging so far. However, what both international observers as well as local observers and African observers have concluded, also ECOWAS, is that there is a lack of transparency. There's a lack of information when it comes to voting in Nigeria. So as I say, the bottom line from observers' perspective is lack of information, lack of transparency of many levels, but no suggestion of vote rigging at this point.
Fanny Fashal in Nigeria. And this election, as we mentioned, is so close in such a way that, you know, until now, vote counting is going on. Many of you have been sending in your comments, although they're divided as the election is too close. So we are going to read some of them. And your suggestions don't reflect in any way Deutsche Welle's editorial standards, but they're just your voices.
And I'll start here, Isaac, with this interesting one from Amtala Ba, who says, please don't blame the INEC too much for the snail's pace of the vote tallying. He says arithmetic has never been their thing.
Yeah, the voters in Nigeria are quite divided. Some are for Atiku Abubakar and others are for incumbent Muhammadu Buhari. Like Abdul Fattah Aden Sheikh says, we expect Buhari to win with a big number in difference.
And someone here is alleging Buhari rigged the election.
Oluwa Hurumanya, just to balance it up, says we are still waiting for Atiku to be declared winner. Anything short of this is something we'll all watch as it unfolds. And like we said, these are your opinions and in no way do they reflect DW's editorial standards.
Moving on to another story that is making headlines, the Catholic Church suffered a major blow today after one of their senior clerics was found guilty of molesting two choir boys. Cardinal George Pell was convicted of sexually assaulting the two boys, aged 12 and 13 at the time, moments after celebrating Mass in the 1990s.
The Vatican has termed the news as painful, and Pope Francis confirmed restrictions on the cardinal, obliging him to refrain from public ministry and have no contact with children. More from this report by Celia Froelich.
The news of Cardinal Pell's sexual assault case has sent shockwaves worldwide. He was the third most powerful person in the Vatican, helping elect popes and run its finances. Cardinal Pell, who is now 77 years old, was found guilty of sexual abusing two boys in 1996 at a cathedral in Melbourne. A lawyer for one of the victims, Vivian Waller, read out a statement on his behalf, detailing what he had to go through.
Like many survivors, I have experienced shame, loneliness, depression, and struggle. At some point, we realized that we trusted someone we should have feared, and we fear those genuine relationships that we should trust.
People from all walks of life have expressed their shock and anger at the revelations.
The little people who were abused in these orphanages, you know, we've been treated like second-class citizens. But now, you know, we've been believed.
I just hope that their God judges them accordingly.
I'm surprised, that's it. But should have been dealt a long time ago, but it's left out now, you know. I mean, nobody can do anything about it. I miss the forgiveness. That's all we can do is do about it. I mean, you can't rewind the clock. It just happened. Can't do anything about it, but it's a lesson for everybody else too.
Cardinal Pell has denied all the allegations against him, and his defense lawyer says they will lodge an appeal against the conviction. The Vatican has said it has utmost respect for the Australian justice system, but will not take any fresh measures before appeal proceedings take place. He faces a potential maximum 50-year prison term after a sentencing hearing that begins on Wednesday.
Celia Froelich with that report. Now to Sudan. Protesters today defied President Omar al-Bashir's ban on unauthorized public gatherings and took to the streets demanding his resignation.
As our correspondent James Shimanyula in Nairobi found out, the effects of that decree is already being felt by the country's 42 million citizens.
Businesses and daily activities have come to a standstill, which is a blow to the protesters whose initial concern was rising fuel and bread prices. Apart from the draconian decrees banning strikes, work stoppage and disabling of public utilities, it also prohibits holding conferences and discussion at meetings. Omar Ismail is an expert on Sudan at the Washington-based INAFO project, which has been calling for an end to genocide and crimes against humanity. Ismail says the martial law entails more.
The national emergency means that now he is running the country through martial law. He had all the powers in his hands. He could order the army to be on the streets, the tanks, any unit of the army.
Mkeshi Kapila, an expert on conflict areas in Africa at Manchester University in Britain, regrets that al-Bashir, himself a veteran soldier who seized the power in a military coup 30 years ago, is still ruling Sudan.
It is staggering that Bashir still remains in power. If anything, he's consolidated his power. And the reason for that is that he's been very successful in playing the divisions within his own country. So we need tougher economic sanctions, financial sanctions. We need to interrupt the flow of arms into Sudan.
The opposition party UMA is now pushing for radical political changes in the country. Here is Miriam, daughter of Sudan's veteran opposition leader, Sadiq El-Mahdi.
My party have been all the time committed to radical change in Sudan to resolve all these crises and to get to peace and democratic transformation through dialogue and or popular uprising.
That was Sudan's opposition leader, Miriam El-Mahdi. And some of you have been commenting on this story. Edwin Chubetingang says, dictators don't leave power by street protests, civil disobedience, or even through the fake ballot. They are ousted by force. And Sanusi says he should step down for the sake of peace. Many thanks for those comments. Welcome back to the program. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And my name is Ipora Nyambura. We welcome those of you listening to us on our Facebook page and, of course, on our partner radio stations. I'll just mention a few names there. Mohammed Ibrahim is saying hello. And we have Vitalis Onyaka talking about APC. Thank you very much for your comments.
And in case you're just joining us right now, our top story today is that Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has extended his lead in the elections as results continue to trickle in. This is a story that we are closely monitoring and we'll always bring you details whenever we can. And coming up also in the next 15 minutes, we will be hearing how solar lamps in Burkina Faso are lighting households that have no access to electricity.
I can do all my work by the light of the lamp. It's mobile too, so I take it everywhere I go. The children can now study for as long as they want in the evenings.
Make sure you don't miss out that inspirational story from Burkina Faso. But first, we head to Malawi now, where authorities have teamed up with development partners to construct a $600 million inland port that will also serve neighboring landlocked countries like Burundi, Rwanda, Sudan, Zambia, and Zimbabwe.
The inland or dry port seeks to lessen the burden Malawi and other countries face in the transportation of goods and commodities such as fuel, farm produce, raw materials, which have to go through ports of Beira and Nacala in Mozambique. From Blantyre, George Muhango reports.
Unveiling the project, Malawian President Peter Mutharika said landlocked countries will benefit from the World Bank-funded project that is slated to start in May this year.
This project is of great interest to the whole region, not only Malawi, but Zambia is very interested, Zimbabwe is very interested, Rwanda, Burundi, Tanzania, the whole extreme interest, and Mozambique itself.
The project is to counter recent studies which show enormous transport costs Malawi and other landlocked countries incur through the ever-increasing fuel costs. At its initial stages, the port will connect SADC and COMESA member states that are championing regional integration and removal of trade barriers between member states. Many Malawians I spoke to are upbeat about the new project.
As one of the traders in Malawi, when we heard that the dry port is to be constructed at Liwonde, we expressed happiness because, you see, Liwonde is also the hub of a rail transport network for Zambia, Mozambique and Zimbabwe. Therefore, we will enable us to trade our goods with other countries at one place and make more business dealings. Unlike this project, the Shire Zambezi Waterway project was misplaced. How could you build it at the tip of Ansanje, where trade does not take place?
As Malawi, we spend a lot on transport. Because most the goods are imported, we lose a lot because each time fuel prices go up internationally, prices of various goods also grow up. So I strongly feel that the dry port will be used for its intended purpose once completed. This will make Malawi's economy grow because other landlocked countries will use the port. This means Malawi will generate forex. In fact, other countries boast of good transport network, and we wonder why we have delayed having this project.
Already, Malawi and Mozambique have a modern rail line in place aimed at facilitating the easy flow of goods once the dry port is completed. The modern rail line that connects the two countries became operational in 2018. But with the aborted Shire Zambezi Waterway inland port, Blantyre-based business guru Brave Gondwe thinks Malawi needs to be serious when handling such projects.
Malawi as a country, we're a landlocked country, and we largely depend on importation. So with the coming in of this project, I think we'll cut some of the cost in terms of importation. In addition to this, we know we are living as a global village whereby we share resources. So I think it will be a good business partnership with other SADC member states who are going to benefit as well from this project.
It remains to be seen whether the project will bear fruits or it is a political maneuver for President Peter Mutharika, who is seeking re-election in upcoming elections slated for May this year.
George Muhango with that report. And commenting on that, we already have your feedback there. Henry Okelo saying, modern agricultural technology to enhance food security and commercial production will be the best that $600 million can offer. Isaac.
Yes, I think that Okelo doesn't agree with constructing an inland port that is worth $600 million. He thinks that money should be spent in modernizing technology in agriculture. And one of our followers on our Facebook page, Devri Jata, says or asks, any news about Senegal election? Well, David, this is a story that we are also following closely and we will always bring it to you whenever it breaks. Rhonda Heston says, I'm listening from the U.S. And Urams Vitalis Onyeka says, APC committed a lot of electoral fraud. Now, that story, we are going to come back to it at the end of the program and bring you some of your comments. So don't go away. We still have much for you right after this.
Africa on the move.
Now, in rural areas of Burkina Faso, often as much as 95% of the population is without access to electricity. And for that reason, two brothers have joined forces to produce solar-powered lamps on an industrial scale to light Africa in a greener way.
Nagazel's Burkina Faso branch made it one of the first to industrialize solar light production in Africa, but there are challenges.
Ibrahim Udriagu drives into town nearly every day. The sales rep is trying to market solar lamps to shop owners. Competition is stiff on the solar market, and the city of Dodugo is no exception. The lamps he sells go for around 30 euros. That's a lot of money in Burkina Faso. But Ibrahim Udriagu says his lamps are extremely robust.
We have Chinese products here which are less expensive. They're cheaper, but the quality just isn't the same.
Ibrahim Udriagu works for Lagazelle. The company's production site is located on the outskirts of Dodugu. Lagazelle made a conscious decision to produce its lamps locally. This means the company can also offer fast repairs if needed. Over 20 people are working here in Dodugu, 10 in the production unit alone. They received 4 months of training. Most of the components are imported from France, as they are not available in Burkina. The materials used by Lagazelle are very durable, which is what pushes up the price. And the lamps are powerful enough to charge up a cell phone on the side. Back in 2008, Arnaud Chaban won the World Bank's Lighting Africa Award. The Frenchman then teamed up with his brother to form Lagazelle and take the solar lamps into series production. For him, quality is everything.
I don't want Africa to become a huge waste dump. Right now, a lot of the products that are imported have a very short lifespan and are not at all recyclable.
Now the company needs more sales reps to market its lamps more effectively, not only in Burkina, but also in neighbouring countries. So far, Lagazelle has sales reps in 5 countries. While the company wants more support from the national government to ease distribution, their customers in Burkina are certainly happy with their lamps. Mamonata Zogu bought 2 lamps last year. She says they've changed her life. And as an extra bonus, she no longer has to go out to charge her cell phone.
I can do all my work by the light of the lamp. It's mobile too, so I take it everywhere I go. The children can now study for as long as they want in the evenings. We have light 24 hours a day.
Ibrahim Udriagu knows that it takes time to convince retailers to pay a little more to get a quality product. So he visits them several times. To him, it's more than just a job.
If I meet people, sell them the lamps, and then they're satisfied, that makes me really, really happy.
The job also means he can support his family. He counts himself lucky that Lagazelle chose Dodugu to base its production. With the firm now planning to expand, his future is looking good.
Yulia Milke with that report.
Focus Europe.
Now, for the first time, British Prime Minister Theresa May has told MPs they will be given a chance to delay Brexit if a deal is defeated again.
Politicians will vote again on her agreement on March 12th. It comes as the main opposition Labour Party has finally offered support for a second referendum if it can't get the Brexit deal it wants. Eddie Mica Jr. with more on this story.
British Prime Minister Theresa May said on Tuesday she would allow Parliament to vote on March 14th on whether to delay Brexit if MPs reject both her deal and the prospect of leaving the EU without an agreement. The Prime Minister said she still wanted Brexit to happen on the scheduled date of March 29th and repeated her promise to hold a parliamentary vote on her deal on March 12th.
If the House, having rejected leaving with the deal negotiated with the EU, then rejects leaving on the 29th of March without a withdrawal agreement and future framework, the government will, on the 14th of March, bring forward a motion on whether Parliament wants to seek a short, limited extension to Article 50. And if the House votes for an extension, seek to agree that extension approved by the House with the EU and bring forward the necessary legislation to change the exit date commensurate with that extension.
London commuters were divided over Britain's opposition Labour Party's move to back calls for a second Brexit referendum.
Totally disagree. We made our decision before. I was a Remainer. I don't want to leave. But we've decided we can't change our vote. That's it.
I see it as pretty much the only mandate they can give Parliament to do anything. It's a bit of an impasse. There's no majority for anything in the referendum.
I think that would be a very good idea, and I would actually vote Labour, and I've never voted Labour if that's what they were doing, because I think the Tories made a complete hash of it. I think that none of us knew what we were voting for last time. We now do know. And I don't think, well, I'd like to think a lot of people would vote differently this time.
I wish it would be a dream if there was another referendum, but we need to respect the will of people. So I'm not able to force a different decision, but it would be nice for me.
Speaking to supporters who earlier this week quit the ruling Conservative Party to join several former Labour MPs in the newly formed independent group, British Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn reiterated Labour's priority was to prevent a no-deal Brexit and to maintain good relationships with the EU nations.
People in Europe are not my enemies, they're not your enemies. People in Europe are our friends, and I want to live in that kind of open and inclusive society. And that's the message that I put, and the message I will continue to put, because that is absolutely what I believe in.
With just a month to go until Brexit, the ultimate outcome is unclear, with scenarios ranging from a last-minute deal to another referendum that British Prime Minister Theresa May has warned would reopen the divisions of the referendum or even scupper Brexit. Both of Britain's main parties are under intense pressure to change course on Brexit, though both are officially committed to implementing the result of the referendum.
Eddie Mica Jr. with that report. Revisiting our top story today, of course, is about Nigeria's preliminary election results, where President Buhari is ahead of his rival Atiku Abubakar. And we have gotten much of your feedback on that story. Chikudu Christian says the Nigerian election was massively rigged by the ruling party APC.
Now, away from the rigging, well, millions of voters in Nigeria took their smartphones to the polling station, and they're complimenting how they have been helpful. Blessings Aung says smartphones can be a force for good and evil depending on how you use it or the way you look at it.
For sure. And we also have someone here by the name Oluya Hurumanya who says we are still awaiting for Atiku to be declared the winner.
Anyway, keep the debate flowing on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Now, in other news, German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas is in Africa, and while he was in Senegal, he said, and I quote, "We can learn from Sierra Leone. Going from a country under civil war to a country that is standing on its own 2 feet. So we asked you, what do you think of your country can teach the world? And some comments are coming in. Auntie Rayleigh says, my country, Cameroon, can teach the world to say yes, sir, to France.
That's an interesting one there. And you have someone from Nigeria here by the name Chikuma Andrew who says, Nigeria in summary is a lawless country, especially for the rich and elite.
Now, these are your comments and don't reflect in any way DW's editorial standards. Consola Fongang from Cameroon says, my country will teach the world corruption, electoral fraud, oppression, suppression, dictatorship, in short, all the vices you can think of. Ah, That's a strong one, Zipporah.
Isaac, I'm sure there's something positive we can also teach the world.
Oh, well, probably yes. Let them tell us on our Facebook page, DW Africa. And on that note, we come to the end of this program. On behalf of the production crew, I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Zipporah Nyambura.
Bye for now. DW. Made for Minds.